Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, February 26th, welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The U.S. has amassed more military firepower in the Middle East right now than at any time since 2003. The region and the world are holding their collective breath. Will the U.S. strike Iran? If so, what would that strike look like? We're going to talk about it today on the show. We'll also debate whether or not the U.S. should pursue some sort of military intervention in Iran. And that's the question we have for you this hour. What do you see as the pros and cons of a military intervention in Iran? Email us, studio2@whyy.org. Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. If you are streaming on YouTube or Facebook, put your comments in the chat.
Yeah, we have two panelists today with differing viewpoints. Look forward to hearing your comments as well. 888-477-9499. The email again, studio2@whyy.org. And Thursday, we usually have DJ of the day. We're going to have it today, but not on the topic of Iran.
Yeah, that felt like maybe it was a mismatch of vibe there. So we're going to do DJ of the day, but the topic will be, Cherry, go ahead.
Black History Month. Today is our final show in Black History Month. And so, you know, the theme could be Black history, culture, rights, freedom, family, legacy, all those things. And a bunch of songs came to my mind.
Yeah.
So
I feel like you want to be the DJ of the day today.
I kind of do, like, but it's going to be executive producer EP Kevin, but get your DJ of the day song titles in by 12:30. You can email studio2@whyy.org.
And we'll pick one to end the show on today. So again, that's studio2@whyy.org. But first, before we do international news, a trio of local news stories. Cherry, start us off.
Yes, the Trump administration has sued New Jersey over an executive order that bans ICE officials from certain state owned property. The lawsuit in question takes issue with Governor Mikey Sherrill's executive order that was signed earlier this month that limits the presence of ICE agents on non-public state-owned property unless they have a judicial warrant. It also keeps ICE agents from using state-owned properties as staging areas for their operations. Under the lawsuit, it claims that the order violates the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which mandates that federal law overrides and is therefore superior to any conflicting state laws. They also allege that the order unlawfully discriminates against the federal government and attempts to regulate the federal government. This lawsuit is the latest in a series of legal actions by the Trump administration to take on local and state governments that have passed laws or otherwise enacted policies against immigration enforcement. So they're being very aggressive here.
Yeah, and I don't know how much, you know, federal law enforcement happens on state-owned property, mm-hmm. how much staging happens on state-owned property. My gut would tell me probably not all that much, but obviously there's also a lot of political importance to this particular conflict. States' rights versus federal rights. A new governor trying to establish that she will take a far tougher tone with ICE and will protect New Jerseyans from ICE. So, you know, that's something that Sherrill talked about on the campaign trail mm-hmm. and has talked about even more, I think, since taking office. I'll also note, according to Politico, that the federal government in its lawsuit misspelled her last name 5 out of 8 times. So Ooh. Maybe more spell checking in the lawsuits going forward, guys. But there is obviously a lot at stake here beyond just whether or not you spell the name right.
Yeah. And by the way, the state AG says they're going to defend against the lawsuit and happy to do so. And so we'll be watching this. I'm sure there are other laws in other states being passed. I wonder.
Right. There could be implications for other states and other municipalities for sure. Speaking of watching, a lot of people have watched as their cars get towed out of sight here in Philadelphia.
Oh, yes. And if you've
And never to find them again. Go ahead, Cherry. Story number two.
If you have ever had your vehicle courtesy towed in Philadelphia, it is a pain. The good news is the city has agreed to fix this years-long problem with courtesy tows.
Most misleading name of all time, courtesy toes. Go ahead.
Cool story by William Bender of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who has been following this saga for quite some time. He reports that the city has reached a tentative agreement or settlement in a federal court case brought by 36 plaintiffs who had their vehicles courtesy towed. The city has agreed to pay $750,000 to the plaintiffs in that federal case and will now if this settlement goes through, now require tow trucks who operate in the courtesy tow relocation program to keep track of where they unhook the vehicles. And Avi, I've had my car courtesy towed. And if you don't know what that means,
it's wild, folks.
Yes.
It's wild. Go ahead.
You park in a place that is legal and then something happens, like there needs to be utilities, there's a construction, or there's an event. And then the city will send a tow truck. They will move your car to someplace. But they don't tell you where that place is. And right. It's up to you to find your car. Sometimes they drop your car off in a place that is a no parking zone. So your car actually gets towed,
ticketed,
and then possibly even really towed.
Right.
Retowed. And people have lost their cars for hours, days. Sometimes they never find their car. They end up having to report it stolen. And so that's what this lawsuit was about. And, you know, the city said, look, you know, they're going to try to change things under this new this settlement agreement. That if a tow truck company moves your car, they're going to put a no towing, no ticketing sticker on it. And they're supposed to keep track of where it is.
My understanding is that if the PPA was the one courtesy towing your car, then they were already
They
were already keeping track. So they made some progress there. But they contract with all these private towers as well. And the private towers seemingly were doing whatever the heck they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So it feels like a fair trade. If you want to participate in this program and get whatever money they get.
You need to keep track.
You have to keep track. And we have so much technology. We have so much tracking technology now. And we have to debate the upsides and the downsides of it. At least use the upsides of it.
I have an AirTag in my car because my car.
Oh, really?
Yes, because my car got courtesy towed. And when I tell you that I walked for miles and miles and miles to find my car. Mm-hmm. And literally.
Did you find it?
Yes, I did. It was north Philly. And I was parked
How
on Spring Garden.
How far from the original spot?
Miles. All the way.
How did you ever find it?
They told me the street it was on, but the street was long. It was like, they didn't know the cross street.
It's on
like,
Broad Street.
It's on Broad Street. You're like, where? So I walked. I just got to the street and just walked. And you hope you don't miss it because it was at night.
Yeah.
And so I found it. I literally walked the sole off of one of my shoes.
Yeah.
So.
And credit to Bill Bender, by the way, of The Inquirer, who has been vigorously reporting this story for years and years and years. Finally, it seems like a solution is at hand.
Yeah. See, journalism is good. This is wonderful.
A good day for the First Amendment.
Yes. Third story. And I know you really like this one. Yes.
I feel like no one's talking about this. Mm-hmm. But on July 4th, they're going to bury a time capsule on Independence Mall, under a new statue on Independence Mall.
Yeah.
And that time capsule is not going to be open for another 250 years.
Wow.
So when America, fingers crossed, turns 500 years old, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The time capsule, by the way, is required by federal statute. There is a congressional law that requires the placement of this time capsule here in Philadelphia. Inside, there are going to be small archival boxes representing each of America's 50 states and 6 territories. So each one gets its own box.
Pretty cool.
The sculpture on top is going to be a sculpture of Ben Franklin's famous Join or Die snake. So that's going to be added to the mall. That'll be a nice addition. And they released some specs today of what the time capsule is going to look like. And here's a fun fact, Cherry
okay.
Gregg.
All right.
Philadelphia is the birthplace of the modern time capsule. The first one was buried here in 1876 for the centennial celebration. So there you go. Philadelphia is time capsule central. We're getting a new one. 250 is a long time.
That is.
That's a long time for a time capsule.
Yeah.
So when are, you know, robot overlords open this time capsule 250 years from now? What should be in Pennsylvania's box?
I mean, and you know, I was thinking about this because you asked the question. And 250 years is a long time, which means it could degrade.
Yeah.
I was like, you got to pick something that could last. You can't put like a cheesesteak or like some pretzels in there.
No,
you
got to
get
a bad choice.
You got to get something good. So I was thinking maybe a brick from the Philadelphia Museum of Art or a brick from City Hall.
I love that.
Something like that. Or a replica of one of the statues. I don't know.
People in Pittsburgh might object to the Philadelphia centrality of that.
Okay, that's true. But we would be one of the things that would be put in there.
Yeah,
like, or a chip of a brick.
Yeah, so yeah, Pittsburgh, you send a brick, whatever the heck you got out there, and we'll add it.
And then little towns in the middle would be like, well, what about us?
But on food, I was thinking a classic Pennsylvania pretzel recipe.
Oh, yes.
Because
the recipes will last.
I feel like the pretzel, I don't know if it really represents Western PA, but at least Central and Eastern,
mm-hmm.
It comes from like the Pennsylvania Dutch tradition. It speaks to the fact that Pennsylvania was established as a welcoming place for people of all faiths.
Oh, that's look at you. You put a lot of thought into this.
And we still all love pretzels today. And we do.
Like, and in 250 years, they'll be yearning for that deliciousness.
Yeah. Or maybe just like a copy of the Pennsylvania Constitution. That would be kind of basic, but it would work.
Yeah, it would totally work.
We're going to work on making a great show for you today. We're talking all about Iran and whether or not the U.S. should intervene there militarily. We have two great guests lined up. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. There are mounting tensions in the Middle East as President Donald Trump openly considers military intervention in Iran. Just last June, the U.S. bombed Iran, citing the growing threat of its nuclear ambitions. That was a limited strike. Today, the U.S. has amassed a much larger arsenal in the region, and Iran itself is grappling with deep internal dissension.
While the president's advisors have suggested a strike could have serious consequences, he has publicly suggested that a military strike could be, quote, easily won. So what are the real options on the table? Could a limited strike spiral into a broader war? Is regime change even possible? And if it is, what would that mean for stability in the Middle East? And how would any of this or all of this impact Americans at home?
We want to break it down today with a couple of guests. Joining us now are Behnam Ben Taleblou, Iran Program Senior Director and Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Behnam, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be with you all. Thank you for having me.
We also have Sean Yom, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University and Senior Fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now. Sean, appreciate you being here on Studio 2.
Pleasure is all mine.
And we want to hear your take, listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Should America pursue military intervention in Iran? What do you see as pros or cons? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat.
I want to read a couple comments to start here so you get a feel for how folks are feeling out there listening to this program. Kay Hag on YouTube says, I seem to remember Donald Trump campaigning on American isolationism. Why is he so interested in getting us involved in foreign conflicts? So tired of him not keeping his promises. And here's a comment from Bill who says, when we dropped bombs on them a few months back, didn't he say, I think he's referring to Trump, that their nuclear program, quote, was completely and totally obliterated. So why do you have to go to war with them now? So let's go start with why now, Sean. Why do you think the U.S. is considering this action right now? Is it mostly, primarily, entirely because of the internal backlash in Iran and perceived weakness there regarding the current regime? Or do you think there are other factors at play?
That's a great question. I think this is an impending war in search of a political justification. The factors that were present in Iran and have been present over the past year in terms of much of its nuclear enrichment facilities and its credible capability to pose a military threat to the United States and its allies from the Arab world to Israel lay in tatters, right? The Iranian government obviously is a profoundly authoritarian regime that is directly responsible for the deaths of many, many protesters on its soil, not unlike many other authoritarian regimes around the world. And so I think when you stack these factors together and you also converge them with some of the ideological impulses that are circulating in Washington, D.C., as well as the changing matrix of interest I think our presidential administration has come to bear upon the Middle East, I think the only viable explanation for this war, why it's impending now, right, at this particular moment in time, is that it's naked opportunism. I don't see a long-term strategic benefit from the conflict.
Just before we get to Behnam, real quick, naked opportunism, explain a little further there.
Well, I think that I think that our administration is riding a bit of a militarist high right now, given the success of the kidnapping of former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro last month. And as a result of that, I think the particular strategy that our Department of Defense or Department of War, I think, has engaged upon is the idea of showing strength through the performance of spectacle. Spectacles which are supposed to be short-term coercive show, short-term coercive operations or actions intended to inflict maximum damage, force the rival or the opponent to capitulate, and thereby secure all of American interests in one fell swoop. I don't think that they are going to achieve that in Iran right now, and I think they're using the success of the kidnapping operation in Venezuela to a very different case in the Middle East, one of the largest countries of the region, and a case, an authoritarian regime and a military that is unlike the country called Iraq, which the US invaded under similarly false pretenses in March 2003 and ended up wreaking havoc with it.
Behnam, I wanted to also get your thoughts on why now, and I'm curious how much you agree with what Sean laid out there.
Sure. Well, again, I actually have reservations as well about the ultimate political end state or the political motive that Sean raised as well. But as to the forcing function, I don't see naked opportunism at all. In fact, I actually see some real forcing function between the end of the 12-day war and where we are today currently, which actually today is round three of indirect nuclear negotiations between the Iranians and the Americans, this time again in Switzerland. Why does that matter? It's actually because the forcing function was not nuclear at all. So while even some self-styled warmonger, not yours truly, but some self-styled warmonger in Washington who would have wanted to go further into the region, would have wanted the opportunistic, to go against the missile program, to go against the nuclear program, the forcing function of how we got here was largely January 2026. In January 2026, President Trump, not once, not twice, but depending on how you count, in social media, to the press, aboard Air Force One, in written statements, on radio, on television, between 8 or 9 times promised support to Iranian protesters that help was on the way. And now, personally, yours truly doesn't believe that there can be such a thing as a nuclear off-ramp to a humanitarian crisis, particularly because a nuclear deal is actually going to entrench the governments of the Islamic Republic rather than actually be able to deliver the mechanisms to help the Iranian street, which, unlike anywhere else in the Middle East, is fundamentally the most pro-American and the most pro-Israeli street, and it happens to be overruled by the most anti-American and the most anti-Israeli street. So we have a real juxtaposition there. And I think the Trump administration, for political reasons, is looking to avoid drawing the two contrasts that are now somewhat apparent with President Obama in 2009. Of course, President Obama chose not to support Iranian protesters, preferencing nuclear diplomacy. President Trump seemed to be at least feigning in that direction, as well as 2013 with respect to Syria, with the red line debacle there. We know that there was a contagion effect in 2014, for example, while invasions by American adversaries are always multivariate. Russia did invade Crimea in 2014, so there's a contagion effect of American weakness that the president may be trying to stave off, both politically, reputationally for him personally, as well as for the country strategically. And then the last thing I would say, if one even dares to talk about this issue in Washington, is morally. Because lest we forget, we wouldn't want to replicate the talking points of American adversaries, which, if we're going to pay attention to the Iranian example, Qasem Soleimani, Iran's chief terrorist, who the Trump administration killed in term one in drone strikes in Iraq, said in 2010 to an Iraqi official that we're not like the Americans, we don't abandon our friends. And if you do look sometimes in US history, both during the Cold War and the post-Cold War period, 1956 Hungary, 1991 Iraq, there are examples where we encourage demonstrations and don't follow through. So I think in the short term, for political reasons, for strategic reasons, as well as for moral reasons, the Trump administration is kind of looking for an off-ramp. And that's why right now it is quite literally 50-50, at least in the minds of the administration, will there be a deal or will there be a war? I personally have different odds. I think it's 20-70-10, 20 deal, 70 strike, but a real question as to what kind of strike, what is the political utility, what is the nature of the operation. And then 10, there's always the chance that America limps along in the Middle East with some combination of economic and military containment, and then begins to draw down when there's another crisis elsewhere. But I do believe the forcing function of how we got here is absolutely the late December and the January 2026 protests.
Yeah. By the way, we want to hear from you. Should America pursue military intervention in Iran? What do you see as a pro or a con? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming. Steve comments, Iran is not Venezuela. Iranians may oppose the Ayatollahs, but they will defend their country. It would be worse than Iraq. Kathleen from Phoenixville is on the line. Kathleen, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, I totally agree that it's morally wrong to attack Iran. And I think the major crisis here, too, is this proliferation of nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war. And that we have a president who is deranged and has sole authority to launch nuclear weapons. You put that all those ingredients together and you're asking for Armageddon.
Yeah, thank you. That's Kathleen from Phoenixville. My question to you both is sort of, you know, I haven't heard a lot about what the objective would be and what the goals are. The president has repeatedly said that he wants Iran to say that they would never have a nuclear weapon. They've kind of said that, but I guess there's not a lot of faith or trust in that word. And so what are you sort of taking as the overall objective as to what would be the goal, it, no matter what the actual decision was, whether to strike or whatever, but what is the objective as you see it, Sean?
I think that's the question that is begging to be answered. I don't know. Because as Benham helpfully raised, I mean, the tactical bridge that links the protests from the ongoing protests that erupted over the past few months to today is the negotiations happening right now in Geneva involving direct U.S.-Iranian contact. Now, the content of those negotiations is pretty clear. The U.S. is demanding, right, in concert with, you know, the obvious objections over Iran, the Iranian government's crimes against its people, that it also adopt a radically different foreign policy, zero enrichment on uranium, an effective end to its nuclear weapons program, an end to all ballistic missile development, and a cessation of support to its so-called axis of resistance, meaning the regional proxy groups around the Arab world, like Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthi movement of Yemen, and so forth, that are linked and receive support from Iran. And many of their operations, obviously, are profoundly anti-Western. They do cause chaos in their respective environment. Now, that being said, those tactical goals are very different than the moral goal of regime change, right? And I think there's a tractable debate to be held on each level. I think where I often become frustrated, and I think this is true for many researchers and scholars who are watching the impending war unfold, they're not quite clear what the objective is a failure to achieve a tactical goal, such as if the Iranian regime, if the Islamic Republic does not agree to halt its development of its ballistic weapons program, which, by the way, is the pillar of its national defense strategy, far more important, I think, than its nuclear weapons program, then does a U.S. military strike shift into this moral category of trying to overthrow that regime altogether? That's the hidden linkage, right? That's, I think, the slippage or the slippage we might get between incommensurate goals that I think may unfortunately drag the United States and its armed forces into another unending war, precisely the kind of conflict that this president promised he would not engage in upon his return to the Oval Office over a year ago.
Let me read this comment from Joe in Pensauken. We're headed for another disaster in the Middle East, where every time we interfere, things get worse, from installing the Shah in the 50s to support of Israel to the disastrous Iraq war, putting the Taliban back in charge after toppling them, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe it's time to stay out and finally let them sort it out for themselves. Given the history, Beckham, do you think that regime change is an achievable goal? Because there has to be some, I'm not saying it's everyone in the military establishment in Washington, but certainly there have to be some people who really see this as an opportunity to liberate the people of Iran from an oppressive regime. As you said, there's this mismatch between what you perceive to be the values of the Iranian people and the values of the regime, that there's some opportunity there. Whether or not there's an opportunity, do you think it's an achievable goal? And what would it take to achieve that?
Well, I think there's a lot there I want to unpack, and I want to pick up a part of where Sean left off, which is that lack of a bridge between strategy and morality. Because I will say, looking at the Middle East for quite some time, those are often two very dissonant forces in the Middle East when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. Sometimes you have to hold your nose and look in the other direction when it comes to U.S. strategy and U.S. values. But actually, this is where actually there is actually a fair amount of overlap
You think
between
there's
strategy
alignment
and
in this
values.
particular case?
Yeah, so basically, regime change makes absolute sense strategically. It makes absolute sense morally. The real question is the cost. The real question is the time horizon. The real question is the risk tolerance for the U.S. administration. The real question is the behavior of U.S. partners in the region, the hedging partners of U.S. In the region. For example, when Donald Trump went to the Middle East for the first time in his first term in 2017, there was a drastically different posture, a much more hawkish posture from the Gulf Cooperation Council states. Against neighboring Islamic Republic of Iran. Then you fast forward to 2025 when Donald Trump again reelected, goes back to the Middle East for the first time for the first time in his second term, and goes to the same exact countries. There's a drastically different approach, at least politically, from some of these GCC countries towards the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the decade of bipartisan U.S. foreign policy failures between those two administrations helps explain. It's not the only example, but it helps to explain. Why, some regional partners in the region are actually hedging more on the Iran threat and are much more standoffish because they live on the front lines of the potential
So
contagion
basically, they
effect
don't
of a
trust us to
conflict with
follow
Iran.
through. They don't trust us to follow through. And so they're saying, maybe
And
don't attack Iran because they're going to take it out on us.
you could widen the aperture here. There was the Saudi concerns over empowering the Shias in the Iraq war. There was the GCC and broader Arab concerns about American half in, half out with the Syrian civil war. There was again the status quo actors in the Middle East to include Israel, as well as again some of the other non-oil producing states in the region that were worried about America doing, secret and then later overt nuclear diplomacy with the Islamic Republic. There was the politics of the Yemen war. There was the lead from behind in Libya. So there were all these things that have caused a lot more hedging from our traditional partners in the region than leads to be seen. So someone like me, a first-generation Iranian American, does see again the moral and the strategic linkage. But the million-dollar question here in Washington is: it's not what is the goal; it is what are the potential goals. Because looking at Iran policy from the Trump administration's perspective in 2025 and 2026, in 2025, for example, within a seven-month period, President Trump pursued four quite different Iran policies. He went to restore maximum pressure sanctions. Then he went for indirect nuclear negotiations. Then he supported Israel in terms of first the defense, then the offense, and then took unilateral military action against the nuclear program. And then ended up siding with the Europeans in the United Nations to have diplomatic pressure on the Islamic Republic. These are very four or five very different approaches that sometimes you would see one administration for 8 years chart one course on. So with the Trump administration and every administration in general covets flexibility, Congress and folks outside covet lock-in. The Trump administration is uber coveting flexibility here. The challenge right now is that the cost of being so flexible is that both your allies and your adversaries don't know what your next likely move is going to be. So if I had to guess where the administration may be driving it, both Iran and the US may be trying to get the other to leave the table first. And then from there, they're both trying to signal that they have more credible and they're both more comfortable with these sorts of exit options, which would mean some kind of a shooting war in the Middle East. And it is essentially going to be, I think, right now, a game of chicken. And in the absence of the Trump administration either articulating or either seeking a larger regime change conflict, which again would not look like some of the stuff that some of the callers said, I'm happy to unpack that in a different question. But in the absence of the administration doing that or articulating that, what you're most likely going to see is basically the Trump administration, plus or minus the Israelis, turning on this kind of concept of the limit of a limited war against the Islamic Republic, which up until the cycles of violence that got us to October 7 and the post-October 7 Middle East, we had only indirectly and asymmetrically. Now really it is a question of direct conflict.
And I want to read this comment from David Began on YouTube, who says no when, to the question of whether or not there should be a military intervention. He says no, the United States should not pursue military action against Iran except as an absolute last resort. And right now, the costs outweigh the benefits. I want to bring in a caller. Ken from Yardley is on the line. Ken, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, and again, I told the other gentleman it may be a naive one. I tuned in late. This helping another country, are we intervening for our own interests, or or the people asking us for help? I understand we can be doing both at the same time, but it's something I read. It sounded like they want us to help them. They have an oppressive regime that they would like out of there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Are they asking?
We'll redirect that question, Ken. Thank you so much.
Ken from Yardley. And this was my question, because I wanted to just sort of zoom in and get a take of what is actually happening in Iran. I know that there have been protests and that thousands of people lost their lives. But what is it like as far as your understanding of what's happening on the ground and what the people in Iran, the factions that exist and what they're asking for or seeking? And I guess, Becknam, would that be you that could answer that?
Sure, I'm happy to start. You know, I will tell you again, it's not just first generation Iranian American, but managing to place and receive some messages. As you know, there was a 3.5 week nationwide uprising, and I use the word uprising because what we've seen in Iran since December 2017 is a boom and bust cycle of protest that looks very, very different from the traditional history of protests from the street against the state and the Islamic Republic. You look at 91, 94, 99, and perhaps most famously 2009, those are political protests where the street identifies a certain element of the state, supports that, you know, reformist versus principalist, things of that nature. But starting from 2017 to present, non-political issues have been causing major political protests. And as much as the word regime change is a bad word in Washington or in the U.S., given the hangover of the Iraq War and the past 2 decades in the Middle East, what Iranians have been actively seeking in greater and greater quantity and quality, in a very different demography of your average protester, in a very different geography of where these protests are being held, in a very different iteration, the time period between protests are shrinking. We have 2017, 2018, 2019, briefly 2020, then twice in 2022, 22 into 23, and then now late 25 into 2026. And when the regime marries these protests with a nationwide internet shutdown, you get mass killings. In 2019, 6 days, 1,500 people.
There's been blackouts.
Is just very briefly, has been an unprecedented number killed, not just in the 47-year history of the Islamic Republic, but in contemporary Iranian history. You know, 30 to 36,000 killed in 2 days and 36 to 43,000 killed in a matter of 3.5 weeks is an unprecedented number for a society that has not seen insurgency or civil war or major land war in quite a while. So the state of Iranian society is in sheer shock, which is why such a highly nationalistic population is in this weird position.
Sean, I wanted to give you a chance to comment on that. Your view of how the Iranian people, they've been clearly, according to Becknam, they've been protesting for years. It's sort of at this crescendo point. Thousands have lost their lives, speaking out, calling for regime change. Your thoughts on whether this is enough to sort of draw the U.S. in?
Well, as Benham said, I think the moral justification of intervening in Iran for the cause of regime change on the side of an Iranian people that obviously and undeniably have been traumatized and repressed by a non-democratic theocracy, right? I think that logic is pretty clear among those who believe in the probity or the appropriateness of that goal. What I question, though, is what, as Benema has helpfully pointed out, what would the actual cost be of such a regime change-oriented operation? I think this is what haunts me and both not just myself, but an older generation of Middle East scholars who saw the United States and warmongers in Washington evoke the same argument when we went into Iraq in March 2003.
Yeah. I want to put a pin in that real quick, Sean, because we're coming up on a break, because Becknam has referred to this and you've now referred to this, this idea of the cost. And I want to get into what the cost might actually look like if you pursue a regime change policy. Let me read this comment from Claire. Even if the U.S. was successful at toppling the current regime, wouldn't the Iranian Revolutionary Guard take over and present even more problems for the U.S. in the region? So we'll look at the potential ripple effects of this hypothetical. If there was regime change in Iran, what would that cost and what would that cause? Stay with us on Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Avi Wolfman, Aaron, this hour, we're analyzing the pros and cons of knowing your own name and a potential U.S. military strike on Iran. Let me reintroduce our guest. Behnam Ben Taloglu is the Iran Program Senior Director and Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Sean Yom is an Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple and Senior Fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now.
And we want to get your take, listeners, at home, on the road, or elsewhere. The question is, should America pursue military intervention in Iran? And what do you see as pros or cons? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for the streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat. We're going to bring in a quick caller before we talk about cost. Justin from Wilmington, Delaware is on the line. Justin, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I have a quick question. I'm a veteran of both the Iraqi freedom, enduring freedom wars, senseless wars, plenty of buddies lost. What is the American warfighter cost? I hear no questions or answers being given about the warfighter cost. What happens if Iran hits us and devastates us in a particular way that puts thousands or hundreds of sailors or airmen just in harm's way, just devastatingly? What is that political cost?
Thank you. That's Justin from Wilmington, Delaware, for perfectly teeing up this yep. next segment.
Avi. So, Sean, let's get into that. If we were to pursue a true regime change operation here, what do you see as like the front end immediate military costs for America? And what do you see as the ripple effects for the region afterwards? I know those are big questions, but we have to try to start to unpack them, Sean.
I'm happy to unpack them. I think that in a word, immense, and then one more word, untenable. I think that the intentions behind regime change when we're dealing with non-democratic states are obviously very good, but the problem is that good intentions don't go to funerals, right? People have to. And when we think about the human costs of these wars, and I'm not simply referring to the costs on the United States military, I'm explicitly referring to the potential mass casualty events that could afflict Iran itself, I evoke a very intense sense of worry about this administration getting itself into a successive series of military actions that will cascade into a full-fledged nation-building or regime change operation whose ultimate cost will be borne by both Iranians and Americans and any other allies that want to join in into the spectacle for at least a generation. So here's what I mean by this. So let's put aside the historical context, being that the United States is really, really bad at democratic regime change in the Middle East. Think Iraq, think Libya, and we think about the broader region, think Afghanistan. Think about all the potential outcomes that could occur from a military strike in Iran that could launch in the next few weeks. Let's take a scenario A. The Islamic Republic is left standing. It shrugs off these attacks and the U.S. looks weak. Let's say that the U.S. goes in either with boots on the ground or with some sort of air assets, fighter jets and whatnot, and U.S. personnel are captured or killed or held for hostage. In that case, who pays the price? Right, we pay the price and ordinary Iranians pay the price. Let's say we have a second scenario. Let's say a regime change or a protracted military operation is marginally more successful. We decapitate some heads of the Islamic Republic. We kill key leaders and we destroy major military assets. And we once again, in the words of our president, quote, obliterate the nuclear program and maybe the ballistic missile assets as well of the Iranian military. But the regime still stands. And in this middle ground scenario, who pays the cost? In this case, again, it will not only be American service persons, but it will be Iranians themselves. There's a very well-known rally around the flag effect that we often see around in dictatorships, whereby autocrats will use the threat or the effect of foreign aggression to take out their vindictive desires and their vengeance upon their own people. We will see more killings in Iran and we'll see potentially more mass casualty events, especially since we cannot guarantee that every single American strike will kill only military personnel or leaders and kill nobody else. So let's say we get the best case scenario, we get regime change. Let's say the U.S., no matter the cost to the American military, goes into the country and overthrows the regime through a combination of air power, coordinate popular uprisings, and maybe boots on the ground. We still get spectacles of slaughter. We know that all wars involve casualties, particularly among the most vulnerable civilians. At that point, the question shifts. Who takes power? Now, I understand that among the Iranian diaspora, as well as the well-organized opposition within Iran, there are obviously candidates to rebuild Iran or to take power in the absence of the Islamic Republic. But to my understanding, there's no consensus who what a post-Islamic Republic government would look like. There's no consensus about what the ideal leader ought to be. The United States has a very poor track record of importing, I would say, political figures and elites into countries that has occupied, I think again of Iraq, in the hopes that they would instantly gain mass legitimacy as the new government of the country, only to watch as that country either embarks upon a period of internecine infighting or engages in intense social conflict and more bloodshed in an effort to recapitulate wounds. So in essence, I don't see any outcome being good for either Iran or the United States.
Let me give you, Behnam, the same question. The cost of some sort of regime change oriented intervention, and then what the consequences of that might be.
The costs are likely to be high, particularly up front. The government of the Islamic Republic, regardless of the type of military action that the Trump administration or the Trump administration and the Israelis would initiate against the Islamic Republic, they are all singing from the same sheet of music. So whether you're a political official, religious official, or military official in the regime, they're all saying that they would even treat a limited attack, let alone a larger attack, let alone a potential decapitation operation or just going towards a defanging operation, they would treat any of these scenarios as a casus belli for a wider regional war. So heaven forbid, but it's highly likely that these folks are going to be acting on their stated goal. Now, why are they going to be acting on their stated goal, even though they are conventionally outgunned by the United States? Because the logic of the way the Islamic Republic has built its defense strategy is to be able to you could say, impose costs or impose pain in other asymmetric ways to be able to get the adversary to not be able to stay the course and be able to continue raining sorties against either the missile targets or the military targets or the bases or what's left of the nuclear program. So because of this stated strategy by the Islamic Republic, it is likely going to be costly. Now, I think where I diverge with Sean is with respect to where the theory exists and where the empirics are. Absolutely, there is a poor track record of regime change from the air alone. Absolutely, especially the past two decades, should be humbling for anybody who is arguing to do more, not less, in the Middle East. But again, to the line that is often ascribed to Henry Kissinger, but doesn't really exist in his memoirs, foreign policy is not missionary work. This is a regime that quite literally has a bounty on the head of the current president, re-upped that bounty with fatwas after the 12-day war against his life, against his property, against the female members of his family, has the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East, is the only country without first getting nuclear weapons that know how to produce 60% uranium. There are so many of these firsts. It's the only country within the matter of 1 year to not once, not twice, but three times without first having nuclear weapons, fire ballistic missiles at the territory of a country that possesses nuclear weapons. These are game-changing kind of things, unless we forget the four decades of anti-American hostility and animosity that this regime has had, that has actually sucked Uncle Sam into
cycle. Is there a reason, though, Behnam, is there a reason that you think in the power vacuum that would be created by a regime change operation, Iran could be different than Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yes. So in the cases of Iraq and Afghanistan, there was quite a bit of social engineering assumed by the U.S. government, and you saw them have to implement, particularly in Afghanistan, a little bit less so in Iraq. But Iraq, there was all these things like political reconstruction teams. That is not necessarily the case when you look at the average Iranian or Iranian society today. It is drastically different than the case of its neighbors. Second, Sean mentioned the opposition. Even in the case of pre-1979, the opposition to the Shah actually ended up coming from outside, not inside. Ayatollah Khomeini was in exile in Paris. And if you look at the names that the Iranians are chanting, even under the threat of bullets in Iran in January, it is only one person. It is the name of the exiled crown prince. So actually, I think there's much more consensus there than meets the eye. Nobody was mentioning Ahmad Chalabi. Nobody was mentioning the INC in the same kind of mass way inside the country or outside the country from 98 to 2003 with respect to the Iraqis.
Iraq,
so absolutely, the theory is much, 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 gives us a lot of cause for concern and worry and humbleness. But with respect to the empirics, there is a little bit more room to be bullish.
Aaron comments, anyone who says there are pros to war has never been in one. And I want to bring in one more caller. We have Steve from Chestnut Hill on the line. Steve, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Sure. My comment is this. I would be frightened at the prospect of Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth conducting any war anywhere. They have both copiously demonstrated the lack of competence and state of mind to do so intelligently and responsibly.
Thank you. That's Steve from Chestnut Hill. And so, you know, given Steve's concerns and just the concerns of what it's like to be in war, and we've heard Secretary of State Marco Rubio say that diplomacy is the option that they prefer. What does a more diplomatic resolution look like? If we say, okay, maybe, you know, the U.S., the costs are too high right now. We don't want to go down the road of full regime change or having military action. Could a more diplomatic agreement, is that possible in this case, or has the trust between Iran and the U.S. been irretrievably broken? And I'll ask you, Sean.
Yeah, I don't see, I see a military strike of some capacity far more probable than a successful, as Benham put it, a successful off-ramp through negotiation, because the demands that the American delegation in Geneva are posing now to their Iranian counterparts cross certain red lines that this regime, to my understanding, are not going to transgress. They include not just the demand for the zero enrichment of uranium, but as I mentioned before, an end to all ballistic missile development. And the reason why I harp on this is that for Iranian national defense strategy, ballistic missiles are its lifeblood. Like, that's like asking us, asking the Saudis to give up oil or Putin to give up his nuclear weapons. Far more so than nuclear capacity, Iran's ballistic missile capabilities are what obviously threaten U.S. allies as well as Israel across the region. So to ask essentially a country framed by mainstream media and framed by some of those allies like Israel as an existential peril to the free world and the United States in particular, and to expect them, therefore, under threat of attack, to give up the one thing that might prevent them from being attacked in the future, I think is absolutely ludicrous. And I think because the possibility of successful negotiations is so small, we are going to see some sort of military strike. And as I mentioned before, my fear, and I think the fear of many other scholars and researchers, including Iranian specialists, is not that the goals behind a military strike, which is to weaken or overthrow an authoritarian regime, mm-hmm. are morally wrong. It's yeah. that we do not know the true costs, and we chronically overestimate yeah. our own capabilities to achieve our goals.
And I guess my follow-up to that, and Beckna, maybe you can answer this. What do the American people get? And if we talk about the major cost of military intervention, and if it were to go full out to regime change, what in response do the American people get for paying that much or giving up that much?
What they get if the president is successful, and that is a big if again, because we don't know the political aim towards which the use of force would be applied at this moment. That wasn't even necessarily put front and center during the State of the Union speech, but the track record of the Islamic Republic and the future threats were. But hypothetically, let's just say it is regime change. What the American public gets, what the American taxpayer gets, what U.S. strategy in the region gets, and potentially in other parts of the world gets, is essentially a boon. I don't want to go so far as to say a peace dividend, but it would basically be taking the arsonist out of the Middle East's various fires. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism. That is not an accident. That is both statecraft and soulcraft for the Islamic Republic. They have created a whole host of terror and proxy groups, and they have co-opted a whole host of terror and proxy groups, giving them significant influence in war zones and conflicts that involve U.S. adversaries, that often involve some level of American assistance to those U.S. adversaries, whether you're looking at the cycle of violence against Israel or Hezbollah in Lebanon, or the Houthis in Yemen, or some of the smaller Shia militias in Bahrain, or whether you're looking at the post-2003 cycle of violence in Iraq, for example, the standing up of Shia militias there. So what the U.S. gets is fundamentally a more manageable Middle East that allows actually Americans who have been voting with their paychecks and with their feet and with blood and sweat and tears to actually begin to do less in the Middle East. Mm. There is no path. I fear this is bitter medicine. There is no path out but through. So if you want to focus on the Don Rowe doctrine in the Western Hemisphere, if you want to pivot to Asia and focus on great power competition, I believe there is no way to do that that leaves the government of the Islamic Republic at the helm.
Real quick for you, Sean, as we wrap up, I'm sorry, and we are almost out of time, but Sean, if you don't think there is a military solution here, and if you think that the diplomatic solution is destined to fail, what is the option for the U.S. here? Simply walk away from the table?
Well, I think that's also an unlikely scenario, because then President Trump will have egg on his face. He will look like he is the one who flinched, which is why I think militarism of some form is the most likely outcome. And by the way, just as a last comment, I agree with Benham that sometimes in order to purge really bad actors from the international system, bitter medicine is required. That point that I've been making in my comments today is that at what point do we concede that the cure may be worse than the disease itself when it comes to regime change operations? And I think there's a lot of historical record behind that.
And we do have to leave it there, but this was an interesting conversation. I thank you both for your perspectives. Sean Yom, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple and Senior Fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now. Thank you for your time, and same to you, Behnam Ben Taleblou, Iran Program Senior Director and Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Appreciate both of your times today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And now it's time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the day. This week, for our last live show in February, we asked for your picks on the theme of Black History Month. Al, hit it. Distant love. And that is Distant Lover by Marvin Gaye, the live version from the 1974. From 1974 at the Oakland Coliseum.
And thank you to Todd in Collingswood for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day.
And by the way, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi. Talk to you next week.